That's me, that's what I think. The demands for justice, losing their hope. Working class solidarity, co-opted. The media. Issues.
That's me, that's what I think.
Danny Schechter, your news dissector. What do you think?
And what do you think? Hi, Danny here. One more week on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. We have a call-in number, 888-874-4888. If you'd like to share your views or engage in some sort of discourse, please call 888-874-4888. It's a free call, of course. Wait a minute, maybe it's not. There's another toll-free number, 877-627-5065. So please join us. We're going to be talking today, particularly in the latter part of the program, about the extremely problematic so-called NSA reforms enunciated last week by President Obama. I wasn't in town. I had flown out to the Sundance Film Festival, where I spent the weekend promoting my book, Madiba A to Z, and also appearing at a Martin Luther King benefit. I was up on the mountaintop in Park City, Utah, and when I was there, I was able to participate in a panel, or at least hear a panel about documentary filmmaking. You know, the Sundance Film Festival, I think now in year 30, has of course become a major cultural institution, the place to be for filmmakers, for fans, for people who are also just want to be where the people, where the big names are, where the movie stars are, where they think they are. So the streets are choked. The films are very hard to get into because most of them have been sold out way in advance. It's $20 a pop to even go in to the festival. So it's a place to be, but it's also difficult in part because the temperature was way down there. Although I came back to New York and I think it dipped even more here in the city to 7 degrees, 9 degrees. Today it's pretty chilly as well. So I got a bit of Utah here as well. And I was there to talk about Dr. King, his last speech, as you will remember, in Memphis, Tennessee, when speaking in that church. He spoke about having gone to the mountaintop. And in a sense, it was a kind of an image of going to the promised land. It was almost as if he had a foreboding. He had a sense that his time on earth was not going to be too long. And so the mountaintop was an image that he used to talk about our society, what was really happening down below, the poverty that people were experiencing, the confusion that many were experiencing as well. So, you know, he, of course, a prophetic leader, an apostle of nonviolence, was honored on Monday, and I was among those paying tribute at Westminster College in Salt Lake City, which is a college that's been there for over 100 years. And it was a very nice event, very nice ceremony, particularly because before the ceremony, the students at Westminster marched in Dr. King's honor. We live in a country that loves martyrs, but doesn't necessarily like marchers. And Dr. King was a marcher and became a martyr. So it was fun to be out there in a way with young kids, Asian kids carrying soccer balls, and students from the school carrying Dr. King's picture. You know, a sign that he is still very much admired and respected. And, you know, I have to confess that one of my, you know, kind of more memorable moments was actually meeting Dr. King. I was active in the civil rights movement, and I was one of the people who worked on the March on Washington as an organizer. So I met Dr. King in New York. I met other organizers in the civil rights movement. Many of them were, let's say, more activist than religious, but everyone respected Dr. King, not only for his eloquence, but because he was a person who put his ideas and ideals into practice. He was willing to go to jail. He was willing to challenge the system and also to challenge the civil rights movement. And many leaders in the civil rights movement were not terribly happy when he spoke out against the war in Vietnam here in New York at the Riverside Church. And there was a split or a separation there, particularly the supporters of Lyndon Johnson, the then president, who had, you know, enunciated a war on poverty and partially in response to the March on Washington, calling for the society to work on eradicating poverty. But soon, because the war was escalating in Vietnam, there was a big guns versus butter debate. And guess what? Butter lost, guns won. And the war on poverty shrunk in funding and importance. And we certainly need a war on poverty today, because the problem of poverty has not gone away in our society. There's been a very marginal improvement. There are so many people out of work, long-time unemployed, who are no longer counted. Youth unemployment, which is at 15 or 30%, depending on what numbers you accept. So Dr. King pointed a way for us, but he wasn't simply the I have a dream man. His thinking went much deeper than that. And so today, he was a man who had a dream, and we have a president who has a drone, President Obama, who is defending and defended and supporting surveillance programs that continue to intrude in the privacy of Americans. And they represent a danger and a threat to the Bill of Rights in our country. And that's why there's a Bill of Rights Defense Committee. The head of it, named Shahid Buttar, is going to be joining us in the next half hour. But there was a big rally in Washington in which he and many other groups and organizations challenged President Obama. Now, ironically, I've just read a report on the Black Agenda Report, which basically suggests that the latest polls show that Obama's biggest support on the NSA is coming from the Black and Latino community, the people who are most supportive of Obama, in part because they see very clearly that the alternative are Tea Party Republicans, who hold them in contempt and are trying as best they can to cut all support for poor people and working people in our country. So we have a situation that's not that different from the 60s, when Democrats rallied behind Lyndon Johnson as a strong advocate of the war on poverty, but also justified the war on Vietnam. And Johnson himself became a tragic figure in that respect, because his legacy was totally dominated by that war, which was very unpopular. And today we have a situation where President Obama's legacy is also being threatened by his support for spying. And this is something that is surprising, because he is a professor of constitutional law. And if anybody should know better, he should. But he doesn't, in part because, you have the sense that he's not really running the show, that other more powerful forces, the military-industrial complex, the intelligence, surveillance complex, whatever you want to call it today, has dominant power. And they undoubtedly have a very thick dossier on him. And so he is towing the line, or trying to waffle around that line, by claiming to support reform, while at the same time basically justifying the role of the National Security Agency and organizations like the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, headed by Mr. Buttar, are challenging that. He was recently in Washington at a rally of people who were trying to take this issue from being an issue that's just criticized by journalists or columnists, but being an issue that you can organize around and can challenge the system. I want to give you a little taste of a poem or a rap that he read at that rally in Washington, D.C. And when he comes on the air at 5:30, we're going to talk to him more about it. But here he is, none other than Shahid Buttar, speaking to a crowd in Washington, D.C., challenging the surveillance state.
A breaks the law every day. It doesn't matter who you are or what you say. They monitor your phone calls and emails anyway. Corrupt courts and Congress. Paving the way. Here's a lesson they want you to learn someday. Watch what you say. They spy on your mind, record your calls for posterity, commit daily executive crimes with impunity. They're the authorities here to keep us safe until inevitably the boot ends up on your face. It's the NSA versus the Constitution. We the people are the ones our agencies are abusing. We can force our government to make a new choice when we build a movement by each raising our voice. When we build a movement by each raising our voice.
When we build a movement by each raising a voice. And that's really the question here. Can a movement be built around these issues? A movement for privacy and freedom of expression. Is this issue of the NSA, going to be something that is simply the province of columnists and politicians who are debating back and forth on it? Or are the people going to get involved and make this an issue? Of course, we have a situation with the Manning trial. Most recently, our whistleblower, Mr. Snowden, from the NSA, calling on the public to make privacy an issue, calling on the public to get involved in this. And many journalists are also challenging this national security state, and they themselves are being threatened with jail, threatened with condemnation, with losing their jobs and all this. Fortunately, we have some newspapers in this country that remember the Pentagon Papers decision during the Vietnam War, supporting this, when the Supreme Court supported the right of the New York Times to publish this document that was supposedly a secret document. But in this case, we have the NSA using the pretext of anti-terrorism to justify its programs. And it's a claim that many who have studied all of this are very critical of. President Obama's speech about the NSA's domestic dragnet was the latest move in what, Buttar calls a continuing shell game, which ignores the vast majority of his own review board's 40 recommendations, prompting the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board and others to basically shut up, because they have criticized him and he, hears it and moves on. So, we're in the situation. And out in Utah, it was very interesting because when President Obama gave his speech last Friday, the Salt Lake City Tribune, the newspaper in Salt Lake City, carried an article about what will this mean for Utah's role in all of this. Apparently in Utah, at a place called the Point of the Mountain, they've built a vast warehouse for internet servers, and it's a headquarters of the international spying that the NSA is doing, where they're saving all of this data, no doubt breaking down lists of names of people that they're monitoring and all the rest of it. And that's happening in Utah. And it shows you again that this whole issue has become not just a problem, but an industry. There are many, many companies that are involved with cost plus contracts. Many of the companies that we know who are in the internet industry, in the space, including Facebook, Google, the telecoms like AT&T and Verizon have all cooperated with the NSA and in some cases have billed the NSA for their cooperation. Get this, NSA requests file number whatever and they provide it and then they send them a bill for doing so. So it's been a very profitable association. Now Google is challenging this, calling for more reforms of the NSA because their business is being questioned. And what we have now is a desperate search among consumers of the internet for protocols that cannot be monitored as easily and cannot be used to abuse their privacy rights. So we have a battle going on here on one hand between Democrats, some Democrats and other Democrats, then some Democrats and Republicans, and consumers and the telecom companies, and activists and the government agencies. So it's a many-sided war or battle that's going on. And it's very important to try to follow all of this as much as you can. The Electronic Freedom Foundation is one company or group that's been issuing reports on this. Many other civil liberties union and other groups have been also outspoken because they're very concerned about the fact, you know, that there's a violation of the Constitution going on here. And some judges have ruled that it is. Other judges have ruled that it isn't. Pretty typical. And so if you're President Obama, you go with the judge who rules that everything you're doing is perfectly legal, whereas critics are saying, no, not true. But it is emerging as an issue in our political system. And I think this is what the White House wants to preempt, because Dr. Ron Paul's son, senator from Kentucky, is pledging to make this an issue and to raise, roll out a petition to aim for 1 million signatures to challenge the NSA and the surveillance state. You'll recall that he himself went through an experience at the airport where he was patted down and improperly searched by paranoid TSA employees. I can report on my trip back from Utah. Because of Delta Airlines, I don't know how, I was put on a line which was said pre-screened. And that meant that I didn't have to take my computer out. I didn't have to take my shoes off. I didn't have to take my belt off and risk my pants falling down. I didn't have to take my computer even out of my bag. So, and they were perfectly fine with that. So I think, again, over-regulation, over-paranoid security enforcement, not only is not effective in catching terrorists, so-called, but it is really antagonizing so many people. Apparently in England, you don't even have to take your computer out of your bag. So, we're in a situation where arbitrary rules based on specious logic, specious reasoning, questionable reports, footnotes that really don't add up to very much, are being invoked and used to justify this gigantic bureaucracy. So in a country where many economists say, look, we're still in a depression, not a recession, but a depression, that long-term unemployment is a structural problem, that there are no new jobs being created, the government can create new jobs, not for ordinary people, but for so-called intelligence specialists, and hence the expansion of the whole national security surveillance system. And you happily find some people like Edward Snowden who get jobs in this bureaucracy and come to realize how crazy it is, how invasive it is, how inappropriate it is, and they have the courage and the guts to challenge the system. And that's what we're seeing. If you want to join me in this conversation that I'm having with myself, 888-874-4888. We're on News Dissector Radio on PRN.FM. And we're here Thursday every week. Pilar Levine, who's usually with me, Polarity One, is not here today. But, he's been here to add a little bit of music and energy to the whole broadcast. So we're still discussing this issue because it's an important issue that doesn't get adequate discussion. Last night, to my surprise, Fox News aired a poll that they had taken, a Fox News poll, saying that a majority of Americans, presumably including Fox News viewers, thought that the information that Snowden was making available was very important, and they appreciated it. So this issue is beginning to lose the partisan divide aspects that have always served, any administration well, to divide and conquer. Here we have a number of people in Congress, in the Senate particularly, who have lined up behind this national security state on the grounds, get this, that it's, quote, professional. Therefore, because it's professional, it can do no wrong. And this is the kind of elitism that is very common in Washington and very out of touch with the attitudes and feelings of most Americans. So here we have Fox News coming out with a poll showing that they appreciate what Snowden was saying. Now, many of these people on Fox News originally were branding Snowden, you know, like the devil incarnate. And they were calling for his head and to have him hung from the highest tree and all the rest of it. Now, with their own listeners, their own community, recognizing that the information that they're getting about how they, too, are being spied on is something that really transcends partisan politics. Of course, they interpret it, you know, as a way just to attack Obama, who, you know, probably deserves to be attacked on this issue. But nevertheless, we have a situation here where the country is uniting behind doing something about the surveillance. And I think we have a president who's not only chickened out, but he's done so for reasons that haven't really been fully reported. Namely, that don't assume that because he's the president, because he's in office, he's in power. It's very important to recognize that often the government is run by people outside the government, lobbyists, corporate supporters and funders, specialized think tanks, various other agencies who are actually running the show, not the public officials. The public officials are up front. They're mouthing off about these policies and practices and all the rest of it. But Congress, I think, the last time I looked, the approval rating was about 10%. So most Americans really don't trust or appreciate most of this partisanship in Congress, you know, where attacking Obamacare is something that these guys live for morning, noon, and night, without recognizing the role, you know, of the military, the industrial complex here, what's left of the industrial part of it, because so many of our jobs have been outsourced. So we're in a situation of a continuing and deepening crisis in our country, and it's not one that gets a lot of media attention. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing this show, one of the reasons I write the NewsDissector.net blog every day, posting it at around midnight, looking for a variety of sources in the news, international sources, various points of view, and what have you, to offer more perspective, some context, some background about what's happening in the news, because that's mostly what's missing. Okay, it's not like what's in the news that's so great, okay, to be criticized for sure, but it's what's not in the news that we need to really worry about and be concerned about and try to deal with. And this is something that, you know, I'm particularly sensitive to, perhaps because I've been in the news business for so long. I worked on the inside at ABC News. I worked at CNN. I worked at CNBC. I've worked in commercial radio for many, many years. I understand how this commercial media system operates. That's why I wrote a book called The More You Watch, The Less You Know, because the more you're dependent on the mainstream, or what some people joke is the lamestream media, the more you are probably going to fill up your head with information that isn't true. So we're in a situation now where almost on every level you have to question, you have to raise issues about what is and is not happening in our company, what country rather, and what do we know and what do we not know about what's happening. And that's not always easy to determine. So you have to do some of your own homework, as we did in school, and read a little bit about history, a little bit about how these events have sort of happened before. Not just looking for a conspiracy theory, someone to blame, but understanding how a system operates and how the United States connects with and relates to other countries. And this leads in many cases to incredibly, shall we say, hypocritical moments. Right now, in Montreux in Switzerland, the place where the great Montreux Jazz Festival happens every summer, is now the scene of an international so-called peace conference about Syria. And we have, you know, in Syria, a war that's going on where hundreds of thousands of people have been turned into refugees and have been killed. We don't know the full body count, really, but it's a horror. 40 countries are gathered there. Many senior diplomats from the UN are there. And the question is, can they talk out a solution or a compromise to what's happening there? And it looks like they're not going to be able to. It seems like one of those gestures that are almost doomed to fail, designed to fail, because they pit people opposing each other who have no interest in resolving the problem. The Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad sees itself fighting terrorists. And in some ways, they're right. A lot of the people who they are fighting are people who are either affiliated with al-Qaeda or a part of these jihadi groups and are funded in part by countries like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who are claiming that they support democracy in Syria when they don't support or practice democracy in their own countries. So we have that. Then we have the Syrian opposition, when there is a legitimate opposition in Syria, who, you know, in a way, were trying to be a Syrian spring in the spirit of the now crushed Egyptian spring, and to try to democratize their country, and that they themselves were underwent repression from the Assad government, and the Assad government has carried out, although there's some dispute about this, gas attacks on some of the opposition, and you know, it's hardly a shall we say, it's hardly a mecca of nonviolence over there. On the other hand, when you put people who have no interest in peace together in a room seeking peace, you know, we have a, you know, a situation that seems to be very untenable. The exclusion of Iran from these discussions, Iran is a big player in that region, almost guarantees that it will be torpedoed. And a lot of this is being done in a way for American TV viewers. You know, once again, it's the perception that's more important than the reality. And we need to understand that here and recognize in analyzing what's going on there that the United States has also been deeply involved in supporting these groups, so-called terror groups, there. So on one hand, they're talking about peace and justice and how Assad is a terrible dictator. On the other hand, they seem to be aligned with groups that have really no respect for democracy either. So that's the crisis there and needs to be followed, because so many Syrian people are suffering so deeply as a result of all of this, are in terrible pain, have lost their homes, have lost everything, have lost their children, have lost their families, and really the world does need to do something to help them. So that's my spiel for this first half hour. We're going to be talking more about the information crisis, the Bill of Rights crisis, the NSA crisis in a few minutes. Stay with us.
We're soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Sanity stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message breakup. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, buy a Coke, buy a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned babies.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's the drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Kindness, right, and ratings pressures.
News Goop, what we need to know. News Goop, what we want to know. We got News Goop, what we think we know.
Till freedom is a rumor.
News Goop.
What we need to know.
News Goop.
What we want to know.
We've got News Goop.
What we think we know.
Got remote control to choose a show. But the more we...
On the one hand, there's the public's right to know. On the other hand...
Because our government institutions, for better or I dare say worse,
don't actually do a particularly good job of minding constitutional rights. The founders of our country imagined that the courts would do that. Unfortunately, our courts are not terribly independent anymore, and at least in the sphere of executive power, whether it's in the context of domestic surveillance or local policing practices, very rarely actually check and balance the executive branch. And as we've seen with the NSA spying powers, for instance, Congress simply is not in a position very often to do effective oversight. So if the courts are co-opted and Congress is asleep at the switch, it really falls to we, the people of the United States, to defend our own rights, and that's why we were founded.
And that's why I have you on today, and I'm really glad that you could join us. It's been a little difficult at the last minute. But nevertheless, I'm pleased that you're with us because, you know, I've been in my past an organizer. I identify with organizers, and I think that what this issue lacks is a really mass-based constituency, even though the polls seem to show that people are very much unhappy with these reports of surveillance and intrusions on their privacy. But the next step, which is organizing, bringing people together, getting them to be a force for change, is just starting, let's put it that way. I know you were at a big rally in Washington. What's your sense of the way this issue is being politicized and creating, you know, can a movement be created around it?
I think it absolutely can, and I think it's a movement that's somewhat unique in that it crosses traditional political boundaries, right? We're on the Progressive Radio Network, and a lot of progressives certainly understand why domestic surveillance is a threat to our most fundamental rights. Also better or worse, and maybe this is actually better, the community in the country that seems to be most sensitized to the ways in which domestic surveillance can enable essentially thought crimes and the criminalization of thought and dissent is not progressives but libertarians. And the emergence of a coalition that combines the force of peace and justice progressives alongside for instance, Ron Paul or Tea Party supporting libertarians is very exciting, and that's a consensus that only runs across a handful of issues, right? Domestic surveillance is one of them. Money and politics is a possible area of alignment, as is drug policy, even if on tax policy, environmental regulation, any number of other issues, those political camps might diverge. The NSA is actually bringing us together and helping diverse Americans from all walks of life remember some of the principles that have long made our country great. And I think the bipartisan, I should say transpartisan, and multi-ethnic coalition that's emerged from coast to coast, north to south, and all points in between is especially inspiring and empowering given the legislative and congressional dysfunction between the major parties.
I reported earlier on the program that Fox News commissioned a poll, a Fox News poll, and found large majorities supportive of the information and appreciative of the information that they've received from Edward Snowden.
No question. He's a hero to people of all different kinds. And I think the majority of Americans from both of the traditional political camps understand that at the moment our government, across each of the last two presidential administrations, across congressional leadership from both of the major corporate parties, that our government is arrayed against us, we the people. And I think that's particularly the when you asked about the emergence of this coalition, I think it's well underway. It's prompted attention from members of Congress who have on multiple occasions spoken about a transpartisan checks and balances caucus, which is coming to fruition as we speak. And I think the Snowden revelations and the controversy they have begat has been one of the primary vehicles for the emergence of that bloc.
Although I'm sure you're not a new player to many of the people working with you, you do represent a kind of a new way of thinking and a political bottom-up approach to this issue. It's not a legalistic approach. It's not the traditional civil liberties approach.
That's right.
So that's why I was really interested in speaking with you. Tell us a little bit, first of all, about yourself. What's your background and how did you get into this issue? And secondly, tell us a little bit about the Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
I appreciate all those questions. So my background, I'm a constitutional lawyer. I came out of Stanford Law School in 2003. My blood's from Pakistan. My family immigrated to the United States when I was 2 years old from England, where I was born. My family are basically religious dissidents from the Muslim world. We belong to a sect of Islam that is reviled in some sectors as heretical. And so we came to the United States seeking freedom, religious freedom, you know, the very same principle that drew the founders of the country here from old Europe. So freedom is a very much not an abstract concept to me, but one that is very concrete. I started college a little bit early, found myself homeless after my family lost our house when I was starting undergrad, worked for a series of banks, of all things, while going to school at night for 10 years, wrote a thesis that got me some attention about the philosophical basis for inheritance rights. I went to Stanford for law school. I studied their antitrust law because I wanted to bust big corporations for the federal government. It's basically the same kind of political sentiment that pervaded the Occupy movement. And then while I was in law school, the series of events that transpired included the Bush versus Gore decision, the 9/11 attacks, and the run-up to the war in Iraq. And that was a very interesting time to examine very closely what passes for law in this country. And while the threat that major corporations posed to our political process was apparent at the time, the response to the 9/11 attacks really forced me to recognize that there was a greater threat to freedom at hand. And since then, that's the set of issues I've been working on. I came to D.C., worked as an impact litigator for actually a private law firm, but worked on marriage equality cases, campaign finance cases, went to work at the American Constitution Society for 3 years. That's basically the progressive answer to the Federalist Society, which co-opted the courts in the 1970s and 80s. And then I went to Muslim Advocates, where I had a chance to sue the FBI in a FOIA case that was ultimately successful, though a pyrrhic victory we could talk more about. And then I've been at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee since 2009.
You know, believe it or not, I also was involved in a Massachusetts Civil Liberties Union suit against the NSA to try to get access to information that they were had collected on me as a journalist in England. And a lower court had ordered the NSA to make it available. They appealed, and it was thrown out. You know, our claims were thrown out of court. But, you know, the fact is that this is not a new issue in many ways, although it does seem to be an issue that has become certainly much more prominent, perhaps because so much more money, resources, personnel, and attention is being paid to it. How do you see the development of this whole surveillance state?
I think the resources have a lot to do with it, and it takes me back to President Eisenhower's departing address in 1961, when he warned the American people in no uncertain terms that our democracy was at risk by the emergence of what he called a military-industrial complex. And remember, this is the supreme Allied commander during World War II, and then the President of the United States 60 years ago warning us of this. So this is absolutely nothing new.
In fact, just if I could be permitted a slight self-promotional plug, if you would. But I did a series, a six-part series called Who Rules America? And one of the programs is sort of based on the military-industrial complex argument made by Eisenhower. You can find that online on YouTube, Who Rules America, Danny Schechter. I've done a six-part series that I think you might find interesting as well.
Okay. But, yeah, I'd love to check that out.
But continuing, so this Bill of Rights Defense Committee sort of emerged and seems to be articulating, and I know that you're articulating not only as a lawyer but as a poet, and I'm going to ask you to share some of that with us in a minute, but tell us a little bit about this organization that you've been involved in creating and are now leading.
So I actually didn't create it. It was founded before I joined. I was hired by the board in year 8 to replace the founding director, my predecessor, Nancy Tulanian. And she was a part of a group of grassroots activists in New England who organized outside the courts, outside the legislature, in citizen grassroots organizing. You described it as a new tactic, in some respects very old, very old approach to addressing these issues
only,
offline.
Only insofar as on this particular issue,
sure,
most of the discourse has been dominated by whistleblowers, journalists, arguments about information and whether it represents a danger to our national security and all the rest of it. And we haven't had popular movements, although there was a defense effort on behalf of now Chelsea Manning and certainly now Edward Snowden, with people popularizing this issue and really taking him as somebody who's been stigmatized and demonized, you know, as a bad guy, as a a spy even, and turning him into a very popular hero.
That's right, and I think that there's a real moment at the political moment now to rediscover those old tools and apply them to the setting in which people have largely forgotten them. But the genesis of our strategy was offline organizing, connecting people face to face at meetings and events in their community to increase awareness about these issues, but then also sharpen the focus and push for, along with transpartisan allies and multi-ethnic allies, reforms short of the congressional level, particularly state-level reforms and municipal reforms that can help restore civil liberties.
You know, this point is an important one because in President Obama's speech, he kind of talked about how he's going to try to get the Congress involved in searching for a pragmatic and realistic strategy, blah, 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 knowing full well that you can't get anything through the Congress. Certainly he can. So the idea that the Congress will be the final arbiter of reform on this issue is setting it up to fail, it seems to me.
I think that's right, though I would also encourage you just to think about it in these terms. You know, the courts will likely take years to resolve the competing appeals coming out of the decisions out of the D.C. Circuit and the Second Circuit. And it will likely be the case that by the time those decisions reach the Supreme Court, they will be mooted by something that happens either in the executive branch or possibly in the Congress. And Congress will do something to attempt to fix these problems. And I agreed at the outset that it will likely be very far from enough. Having said that, Congress is at the moment contemplating reforms that are far more aggressive than what the president has announced his receptivity towards. And they're also far beyond what the judicial decisions present, what the court challenges present the judges with the opportunity to address in their decisions.
I mean, wasn't there a Civil Liberties Oversight Board created, a Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board that came up with 40 recommendations and have been dismissed by the president?
To a large extent, and you're very timely, actually, because the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which is separate than the one that you're talking about, there's two boards to talk about. But the PCLOB, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, released its findings today, and they were very, very aggressive relative to the very limited articulation of the issues that the president made a week ago.
Hold on a second, because I want to do something that we hear in the news a lot. Breaking news. Breaking news. So break it down to us. What actually was decided today? Because most people, I'm sure, don't know it.
Haven't heard of it yet. Yeah. So the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, just a quick piece of background here, its creation was recommended by the 9/11 Commission 10 years ago. It took 10 years to get anyone to staff the board and get it any funding. Its first report was released today, and it was about the NSA spying activities. It's a bipartisan panel. With three Democrats, two Republicans, it broke along those party lines, interestingly enough, despite the transpartisan alignment in Congress, in which the three Democratic members of the board recognized that the NSA's bulk collection programs are unconstitutional, haven't had any useful security purpose, and to that extent should be ended. The Republicans on the panel agreed with respect to a great many among the PCLOB's recommendations. They did not go that far as to say that the program was unconstitutional, but they did support measures to curtail it far beyond those that the president accepted last week. And that is to say the president's own appointees to this board all agreed that he should do more than what he has accepted. There was a prior board, the president's Global Signals Intelligence Review Board, review group. That's the one that issued the 40-plus recommendations in December, most of which, the vast majority of which, the president flatly ignored and did not even address in his speech last week. The president, to his credit, announced some meaningful reforms with respect to the Section 215 telephony metadata collection program, but that's only one among dozens of NSA collection programs, none of which, except for that one, the president has voiced any interest in curtailing.
So
and all that is to say Congress is where the action is at the moment.
So here you are, folks, hearing it first on News Dissector Radio, what actually happened today and the significance of it from somebody who's been monitoring it very closely. Now, one would think that someone trained at Stanford, when you're trained at Stanford, either you play football or you become an investigator. investment banker, okay? But you've gone another way, and you're really trying to do an outreach here to the public. You're not just trying to get people involved in this on their in their heads. You're trying to get them involved in their hearts and get them emotionally engaged as well as intellectually involved. And that's, I think, a really important step, and I'm very impressed with it. But in the course of it, we played a little taste of the poem that you read at this rally in Washington. You're also a writer, a poet, a creative person, and I wondered if I could impose on you to share a little of that poem with us and tell us how people can help you get that out.
You're very kind. I'd be thrilled. And there is a Kickstarter to record NSA versus USA over a house track and shoot a music video, but the rhyme goes something like this. The NSA breaks the law every day. It doesn't matter who you are or what you say. They monitor your phone calls and emails anyway. Corrupt Congress and courts paving the way. There's a lesson to learn someday. Watch what you say. See, they spy on your mind, record your calls for posterity, commit daily executive crimes with impunity. They're the authorities here to keep us safe till inevitably the boot ends up on your face. It's the NSA versus the Constitution. We the people are the ones our government is abusing. We can force any agency to make a new choice when we build a movement, each raising our voice. They lie about the origins of the evidence. They lie about the numbers of Americans watched, immense, too large for them to calculate, they say. Don't forget we're talking about the NSA, computing power unmatched in human history, presuming the power to wiretap humanity. It's insanity how large the hubris looms. The government's watching you in the bathroom, and they lie about it at every opportunity. Sustained abuses of every community, unity across Washington, D.C., all three branches against you and me. See, Bush signed in secret a presidential decree. Obama talked a big game, but presidentially did everything he could to entrench the Bush legacy, a complex composed of military industry, predicted 60 years before Eisenhower said it would be rising in the wings for generations growing, a crisis in democracy sowing. The future is at stake. You can start by knowing it's the agencies against the Constitution. We the people are the ones our government is abusing. We can force anyone to make a new choice when we build a movement, each raising our voice.
Wow, wow, wow. Beautifully put, powerfully written, nicely performed, and now you want to try to bring this out, you know, with some music and in a video format, and you're asking for people to help. How can they help? What can they do right now to help get these words out to a larger audience?
You can visit my website, ShahidBhutar.com. The first point, first post points to a Kickstarter page where you can Google Kickstarter and my name, Shahid Bhutar.
Spell it for us, please.
Yeah. My name's spelled S-H-A-H-I-D, Shahid Bhutar, B-U-T-T-A-R. ShahidBhutar.com is my personal site. The Kickstarter site is Kickstarter.com. And would certainly love to bring NSA versus USA to a dance floor near you. To your point from before, I think the resistance to these issues has to be much more than merely political. It has to be cultural. And that's what motivates my work as a political artist, in addition to an organizer and a lawyer. And I think that we have to resist on all fronts. You know,
well, I know the power of that. I was involved, Shard, in organizing the Sun City record against apartheid back in the 80s, which was a powerful statement by 58 artists. And little Stephen Van Zandt was the one who created it. He's on his way, as we speak, to South Africa with Bruce Springsteen and his band playing in South Africa for the very first time this weekend. So
that's amazing.
You know, it's... shows you the power of culture and the power of this poem that you've written. I have to say that I was really impressed with it because it's very informative. And I'm sure if it gets out there, it will trigger a lot of debate and people wanting to know more, which is really the point of all of this. So thank you so much for agreeing at the very last minute and accommodating us in your schedule to come on the show. I hope it was a good experience for you as well. The actual podcast of this program will be available in the PRN FM archive, and you can get it there. I listed it in my blog at newsdissector.net. I hope to have it up tomorrow. Thank you for being here. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org, and we'll go out with my In Debt, We Trust anthem.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me on, and keep up the great work. It sounds like you've done some amazing projects over your time. I look forward to staying connected.
Okay, we're having a couple of little problems here, but maybe we can resolve them. It's called In Debt We Trust, Anthem. Okay. All right. Well, whatever. Thank you for being here with us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Are we all set?
Appreciate it. And we're moving on with the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector.
Thanks, Danny.